Welcome to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro, and this week my guest is Glenn Fleischman, freelance technical journalist. Glenn, good afternoon.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for being on the show. I'm delighted to have you. I'm glad you had time. You're one of my favorite writers, by the way.
Thank you so much. That's so kind of you.
I love your stuff. So when I talk to writers, it's always of interest to me, and I hope the listeners, to find out how you got started. I know mine was a circuitous story, and I'd like to find out about how you got started in this business of writing. What were you doing earlier in your career?
Well, yeah, if you've got a few hours, I could tell you the whole story. Yeah,
we have 30 minutes.
I've always had I have had a technology interest since I was a kid. I've always been, I feel like I mind meld with devices. Like I just, as a kid, everyone always asked me to program their LED watches, you know, or else back in the LCD watches, adults would always give them to me. And it wasn't so mechanical. Like I wasn't one of those kids who took apart watches and reassembled them, but I was always interested in, you know, essentially digital technology. And I happened to grow up in the 70s and I was learning how to program before I had a computer. I was so fascinated by it. And then when I actually got my hands on one, it was cool.
Yeah, so
I kind of came from it from the aspect of being interested in programming and technology. And then, you know, there's a programmer mind. I think there are people who are well-suited to it and less well-suited. And I can program, but it's not – I don't get into that great fugue state, that flow state very often when I program. I pursued graphic design, of all things, as an undergraduate degree, thinking I'd go into that as a career. Wound up getting sidetracked into doing like a technical support at a big, cool teaching facility run by Kodak in Maine, where I was running 100 2FX computers.
Oh, nice.
Because I always knew how to make things work. And that's what got me tapped into there. I'd worked as a journalist in my college paper. Maybe since I was in elementary school, I was always writing for, you know, newspapers. But in college, I was pretty serious about it. We didn't have a journalism program. And then somewhere it all kind of came together where I went to work for a computer book publisher in Seattle. I started doing some article work for what was then Aldus Magazine in the long ago days before it became Adobe Magazine. And ultimately, even though I've done a bunch of different things, journalism's been the through line. So at this point in my career, I kind of came at it from programming, technical interest, tech support, then into publishing. And now I just work mostly as a journalist and as a technology editor.
Did you start off with a Macintosh and a Laser printer and doing desktop publishing?
I had an OSI C1P, if anyone remembers Ohio Scientific. It had a 6502 processor, just like the Apple II.
Yes.
But was much cheaper. I didn't own a Mac until I was in college. But my high school journalism teacher, she was very forward thinking. So in 1985, she bought one. I was the typesetter for the school paper, for which I was paid separately. And we had old CompuGraphic equipment. She sent me home with the computer over Christmas break, said, learn how to use this thing with PageMaker 1.0. I did. I came back and we started typesetting the paper on a Mac. And I've pretty much had a Mac of some kind. You know, I've owned some Windows machines along the way, a bunch of Linux boxes, but my primary computer has been a Mac pretty much since 1985.
For the listeners who don't remember, back in the early days, we had text-based word processors where we had to insert special commands, control characters. So if you wanted to have something bold or indented, you had to type in these special commands in WordStar, and then that was sent to the printer, and the printer would recognize those, and then when the Mac came out and what you saw on the screen was exactly what you were going to get on the paper, people started having the polite word and they were getting very excited.
Yeah, I was one of the last people trained as a typesetter, I think I would argue. I mean, I'm sure there were, you know, thousands of people in that era. I'm not like the last person, but – and there are still people who do typesetting, absolutely, although they're more often in the design, more called a graphic designer, a typographer, or they spec things. But I was trained as a typesetter in my high school paper, and then I worked for a local firm, and I typeset. I typed stuff in. I formatted it. I did it to spec. I did that in college too. It was part of how I was able to afford college, and I came out of it with a bunch of principles, but I feel like it was great. I had a friend who was a music copyist. She used to do the hand work in which you would take a composition and you'd split it out into the parts. It was all by hand. And her profession sort of disappeared and changed because composers could then use software. And I feel like there's a bunch of professions that were obsoleted in a very interesting way, and sometimes to the detriment of the creative professionals, because the expertise of typesetters or music copyists of other people was lost. We knew stuff they didn't, and it took decades often for that knowledge to seep into the digital products and give them the same sophistication. I mean, InDesign really only until the early 2000s had the same sophistication I could do in the 1980s with a dedicated weird old computer typesetting system.
Those were heady times. So yeah. How did you get in with the Seattle Times? Was the typesetting part of that?
No, I was already – by the late 90s, I was working a lot as a journalist. I had a startup company I ran that was doing websites for a bit. I worked for Amazon. I was doing conferences, but I was always writing along the side. And the Seattle Times had a dedicated computer section, as a lot of publications did in the late 90s and into the 2000s. And I called the editor up and said, hey, you know, the Mac's a big deal. You guys don't have one. What if I wrote, every other week, not weekly, a column about like how-to stuff for the Mac, like very practical, not news coverage, whatever. He said, great. And I did that for many years, over, I don't know, 8 or 9 years every other week. At some point, I got Jeff Carlson, so local fellow, good friend of mine. He helped spell me when I had my first kid, and we started swapping off. And then he eventually took over the column and still writes it to this day. So the Seattle Times is possibly the last newspaper besides the Houston Chronicle that has a regular Macintosh or Apple column.
Interesting. I want to hear about Amazon. What was it like working for Amazon?
Oh, it was pretty fascinating. So I used to give Jeff Bezos encouragement. That's how long I've been in this business. I had a web company in 1994 with a partner who then bought out, and that ran from about 94 to 96. And so this guy, he's a friend of friends, moves to town, guy's name's Jeff. He has these crazy ideas about starting a bookstore online. I knew something about the book industry because I'd worked for a computer book publisher, which was a packager that worked with Peach Pit Press. And I had some knowledge from some other sources, some book people I knew in the book industry. And I thought it wasn't going to work. I didn't think there was a good way for it to pull it off. And but we knew people in common. I had lunch with him. We'd talk with him. I'd give him my advice when he asked it, as much useful as that was. And then, you know, and the initial model Amazon had changed a bit into what it became. They originally thought they were going to co-locate with book distributors. They'd be in like a warehouse and shipping books out directly. And they changed that model very early. But I knew one of the first hires, employee number two, I think, was a friend of a friend. And at some point, I was trying to figure out what I was doing with my business. I was having lunch with Jeff Bezos, and he said, "You know, you should join Amazon if you're really looking for something to do." And I said, "I am. I kind of pursued this idea as much as it's worth. I'm looking for my next step." And so I sold my company and joined Amazon in late '96.
Boy, you were in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, it was interesting. I was there 6 months. The place was going through enormous transformation. I left before the IPO. I didn't invest any stock. I have no regrets. I met my wife during this period. We started dating. I thought the company was about to fall apart. I was very frustrated with management. Thought a lot of bad decisions were being made. And I was not feeling very well. It turned out I had cancer, which I got treated for the next year when it came full blown, and survived that just fine. But I was ready to leave. I walked away from millions of dollars. I do not regret it one bit. It was the right. It was a great place to be for a few months, and I was glad to be rid of it when I was.
It probably really helped your career.
I learned a lot. It was, 6 months, and it was like years worth of knowledge. Mm-hmm. And, to be honest, I could drop and say, I worked at Amazon. I wound up doing some consulting for Powell's Books later on their system for Half.com when they were, after they got acquired for eBay. And it gave me a lot of insight into writing about the innards of .coms and networking and so forth when I was doing very technical writing in the late 90s, often for publications like InfoWorld and Network World. And some like that, I did a lot of deep tech stuff then.
Did you ever meet the real Bob Cringely in person?
No, I haven't. I met his editor, some really lovely people at InfoWorld in the late 90s. They were very supportive of me, even though I didn't write that much for them. That was great days. I was in the, Burlingame offices back when they were down there in the old days.
I remember InfoWorld. I read it religiously every week.
It was great.
Especially Notes from the Field on the back page. I think John Dvorak had a column too.
Yeah, back when he was slightly more rooted in reality, let's say, as opposed to getting page views. He was always a very incisive writer. Bob Metcalf, Brian Livingston, all these terrific people that wrote. And if you remember, Chad Dickerson, who is now the head of Etsy, was their IT director, the CIO, I think, maybe rather. great guy. I always liked dealing with him. He wrote a column, I think. And then one day I'm like, hey, he's the head of this company. This is cool. And Etsy's done, I think, pretty well. But nice transition from somebody out of IT and CIO into being the leader of the whole company.
I think it was Mac Week that inspired me. I read Mac Week religiously when I was in Oak Ridge at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory, and writers like Henry Knorr really inspired me to get things off my chest and get into technical writing. Never mind the fact that I'd been an Apple II developer, so I was kind of already rooted in those things.
Oh, I love Mac Week. I lied about the demographics like everybody else and got a copy.
exactly. We all did that. Mac Leak, I believe it was called.
That's right. I have a Mac the Knife mug. It's still intact, hasn't broken for the one leak I gave to Mac the Knife.
I have one from Bob Cringely for Notes in the Field that I sent him.
Oh, that's pretty good. Yeah. I tell my family, like, do not break this mug. They do not make more of them. It's the only one.
So who are you writing for these days?
Well, I was writing for a bunch of publications. This last year, I had a magazine I shut down, and in late 2014, so 2015, I started out writing for a ton of people, including Economist, MIT Technology Review, Fast Company, Tidbits, Six Colors. I'm losing track of who I was writing for even. A lot of great people. Harry McCracken, used to be at PC World, is at Fast Company now, and had a great time writing for him. MIT Technology Review has some great people. I have a long time affiliation with The Economist. I was writing for them for about a decade. But then as the year wore on, I started moving to doing more work as a freelance editor, and now working about three fifths of my week for The Wirecutter, which is a product review site that does really intensive reviews. It's like combine what used to be the labs at IGG or other companies where they do intensive testing with experts and do benchmarking. And there's still that happens in some places, but a lot of the labs at tech publications are basically gone, or individual writers have kind of set up their own apparatus for doing things. Like Michael Brown, always read it at IDG, who's still there, writes great router reviews, for instance.
Tom's Hardware too.
Yeah, and Tom's Hardware is probably the most significant one. They're a little more of a virtual company, but like the centralized labs at IDG had, those are gone. So Wirecutter is like almost the labs of a tech or consumer publication, like Consumer Reports, but coupled with a really practical approach. We often ask readers about what they're interested in finding or what they're using, and it's kind of fun. And so it's a really great independent group. And then I'm doing a few things a week. I do the podcast for Macworld and write the Mac 911 column. I took that over from Chris Breen when he left for the Fruit Company, excuse me, Cupertino, that he went to work for, along with a number of other writers around the same time. And I write a Private Eye column, which is about security, privacy, and similar issues for Macworld.
I'll talk about security and privacy in a second. I think that I've detected that that's one of your favorite subjects.
It is. Yeah. But it's funny. I was doing so much. Now I have like Wirecutter and Macworld, and that's kind of my whole thing. I do a few things here and there. I'm doing some Take Control books with Adam and Tanya Enks, which I've been doing since they started with those. So I got one I'm working on right now with them. But my life has calmed down a little bit. It's almost like having a job between all the different things I do that are regular.
You don't sound like you're calmed down.
Well, for me, it's funny. I know people are like, you're doing so much. I'm like, really? I'm doing about 25% less than I was a few months ago. It's relaxing.
Was it Jackie Chang that founded Wirecutter?
It was Brian Lamb, but Jackie Chang is the editor-in-chief of the overarching site, and she was one of the early hires. So Brian was at Gizmodo and got really burned out from the pace there. He took a few years off and like totally changed his outlook of like how he wanted to approach life. And then he founded this really quiet site that was slow. And we do deliberative things. Mm. We don't publish, we don't constantly update things. We're not pushing news out as opposed to, 50 posts a day at Gizmodo. And he had Brian X. Chen, who was at Macworld, helped him, was one of the co-founders. And then he's now at the New York Times. Then Jackie Chang was brought in, gosh, was it a year and a half or more ago, or 2 years ago, as editor-in-chief. And so she is the editorial director of the whole setup. And she's fantastic to work with. Brian is great. It's a really lovely group of people, including people used to be at like Maximum PC, Mac Life, a bunch of places that we all know have all kind of migrated into this new organization.
Are you an editor at Wirecutter, or are you actually evaluating products?
I am. I have a unique title. I'm editor at large. So I'm working under contract, and I work with a bunch of the senior editors on things like batteries and surge protectors, cellular plans, Wi-Fi hotspots, things like that. So I drop in on a bunch of different topics, mostly in the technology side. Although I had the opportunity to do a top-level edit of a winter boots guy, where I'm going in with an outside eyeball to look at it and see what needs to be tweaked. So that's fun too. It's not just. I mean, it's kind of nice because they have a wire cutter is all about technology, and Sweet Home is their sister site that is all run by a different group of editors, but same overarching structure. That's all about home products, and so clothing and things like that too. So I got to drop in and do some work there too, which is fun for a nice change for me from all the technology stuff.
Wire cutter is a great site. All you listeners should check it out. So a couple of years ago, I ran across an article from you on security that talked about OS X and certificates. It blew me away. And I think I linked to it or referenced it in my articles maybe three or four times after that. It was awesome. Do you remember that?
I have to go back and look at it because I learned so much for it that I learned so much for it that I put into that one article that it's actually my own reference. Like, I've forgotten some of the things. I have to go back and read it. I feel like I write this article over and over again in the years since because the entire system that protects security, like encrypted connections between your browser and a web server or an email server, the system is very fragile, and it relies on certificate authorities who are kind of anointed parties, and people inside the authorities can be suborned, and stuff that shouldn't happen happens. Certificates are issued that shouldn't be, and there are sometimes exploits that are used to gain access, and we're relying on a very fragile system to protect our security worldwide. Things keep changing, but I keep writing that story because it hasn't changed enough that we can just rely on it all the time.
Well, with that, I think I want to take a break here. So, folks, we'll be right back after this commercial announcement.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
And we're back. Thanks, Kelly. So, Glenn, I know you are an expert on all things Apple, and I wanted to ask you about how you're feeling about Apple these days. And I want to talk about several different subjects. Let's start with iTunes, our favorite subject. endless words have been written about iTunes, how maybe it should be factored, how maybe it should be fed to the wood chipper, how maybe it should be trashed and start all over again.
I don't know what it is anymore. It's not it. Everything in it is hard to use. My wife, she's a very sophisticated technology user. She's not a technology writer. It's not how she makes a living. But I call her the early rejector. It's been a joke in her house a long time because I'll install stuff. I'll buy new hardware. I'll do something. And I'm not an early adopter because I write about technology. I often get stuff before it's fully baked because I need to write about it. So she's aware of that. But she'll be like, look, it's been 6 months since OS 10 dot whatever has been released. Is it time for me to install it? I'll say, yeah, now it's time. You're right. You're good to wait. Now it's cool because dot 02 or 03 is out and it works. So I listen to her. iTunes to her is practically unusable. I write about it. I write Mac 911 answers about it all the time. I'm always hunting for something to do, or I'm finding inconsistent behavior. I was writing something about hiding purchased apps in iTunes, like how you could keep this from showing up, and it doesn't display right. Like there's a wrong, like some people get it correctly. Multiple people have written in that the display is even wrong. So it's mashed together too many different kinds of things, too many tasks. The code base is crappy because it doesn't work consistently or reliably. It's like a wrapper around like HTML plus other kinds of utilities built in. It's a backup. You know, it's a thing you use to backup locally to your iOS devices. It should be a bunch of different really well-made modular interactive or interconnected pieces of software, not this monolithic piece of junk. So that's – I don't have any real opinions about it.
So I guess you love it.
Well, I don't know. Everything that came out with the new release, I don't know where anything is for like weeks. I'm like, I'm just looking at the thing. And
what do you think Apple can and should do?
Well, I feel like they don't have – it doesn't feel like there's a top-down direction anymore as there was in the past, even when the software wasn't perfect, that ensured some kind of consistency, a lack of bloat. I mean, especially in the software side. Like I want to say Apple's hardware execution – is very high. Like I bought a watch and I sold it because I didn't find it useful to me. I didn't find the software that useful. I found that the operating system and functions, but the hardware is great. I have a new Apple TV. The hardware is great. You know, I got a Mac Mini last year, one of the newer models, excuse me, from 2014, I think it was. It's great. Like I have no complaints with what Apple is turning out in terms of their ability to perfect hardware products. But I feel like there's nobody in there who is demanding Apple employees eat their dog food in the way they used to, where they experience pain points that then are solved because they're painful. Or there's some blockade in the company that when you have things like iTunes should have been a top priority years ago to fix. And I know OS X is a less important part of the business, but it's still a critical thing that binds loyal users into their ecosystem. And it generates billions and billions of dollars between both direct purchasing of hardware and also the ecosystem of software and media around it. So there's no good reason that iTunes remains as awful. And they obviously devote engineering effort constantly because you see improvements. The wrong approach has been taken for many years, and there's some mindset they're locked into there for that. For you know, Photos is better, but it still has so many problems. This many months, a year. What are we in now? Not quite a year in to its release. Their services, like so many things, do not meet the standard of quality I expect from them, which is higher than everybody else in the industry, but they should be able to meet because you see them executing on it in certain areas and certainly in hardware. So something's not right.
I hope something's going to happen. Apple has to have gotten the message by now.
I think they're still recovering from some bad directions they took a few years ago that weren't as apparent, and now we're seeing the outcome of where they put their effort a few years ago. Because changing iTunes, I mean, that's a multi-year mission. I've been an Apple developer in the past or been part of the program. Excuse me. And, you know, I've watched iTunes Connect improve. I publish books through their iTunes Connect program as well. And that's gotten better. It's not great, but you can see their effort there, the introduction of Swift as a new language. Like, they're working on a lot of fronts to make things better, but it doesn't feel like enough is happening comprehensively fast enough. I think they have a lot of old systems and old software development techniques in-house that they're stuck with, and they need to break out of that, and they have the money to do it and the leadership to do it.
They do. And you mentioned a little while ago the Apple TV that you love, 4K. How do you feel about Apple's decision not to include 4K?
That doesn't affect me yet. I have mixed feelings about 4K. I think I don't own a 4K set. I own a 1080p, and I think 4K is definitely the future, and it's gotten pretty cheap, pretty fast. But I don't know. I think at this point in time, I don't think it was foolish of them. It would have set the price point higher. Would have I think it would have made a lot of things more difficult. So I can see them introducing that when they feel the market has matured more. But that doesn't bother me as much as, say, the Siri remote's design.
Yeah. Well, talk to me about Siri, because I've had my own misgivings about the usability of Siri. One time I tried to delete an app from the Apple TV, and it said, sorry, I can't do that. You know, if you can launch an app from Siri, why can't you delete an app from Siri? Things like that.
I feel like it was the Apple TV was, you know, clearly being incubated for a long time, the new version, and then it shipped seemingly abruptly, like it wasn't ready to go when it shipped. And I think we're still seeing catch up because I don't find Siri that useful. I do not like the remote control design. I think it's beautiful and very clever, and it is not useful. I pick it up and do things accidentally with it. It's impossible to tell the orientation easily when you pick it up blind. The minute they, yeah, it's just it's. I don't know what I'm doing. I mean, I'm sliding. I swipe down on the touch part, and it moves left and right. I'm like, my finger was going vertically, and you're picking up horizontal motion. This is the fundamental thing it shouldn't do. The second it added, they updated it to support the Apple Remote app, I have barely touched the Siri remote since, and only for specific features that I think I need to do with it. Because I just prefer the app. I want them to make the app better and replace, you know, do a recall on the remotes and give us a new one that actually makes sense.
Well, first time I tried using it, I put it in my pocket when I was done, and the pocket lining brushed against the touch-sensitive area, and all sorts of wacky things started happening. So,
oh, my goodness.
Putting it in your pocket is not an option.
Yeah, it's beautiful. This is the thing I keep coming back to. It's beautiful, like the Apple Watch, and I don't feel like Apple favors aesthetics over function, but I feel like they are not achieving the same degree of finish in the software and operating system side that they used to relative to hardware. The hardware wasn't quite as perfect, and the software was better relative to that. Now the software is worse and the hardware is better. And I would say, I think iOS 9 is a pretty, and especially, you know, I'm using 9.2 now. I have an iPhone 6S. I think that's a pretty darn good combination. I don't have that much friction in that experience. You know, there's certainly issues, but I feel like they finally shaved most of that out. I want the same thing in everything they do, not just in, you know, not just in iOS and the iPhone. Even though it's where they make most of their money, I don't care. I want them to support me across everything I do with them.
That's right. That's right. Well, you know, Apple makes a lot of money, and there are people who think that Apple should spend money in the way that they think Apple should be spending money. And Apple likes to be prudent with its resources, but still, one gets the feeling that sometimes money isn't being applied in certain areas.
Yeah, and it's management too. I know it's a problem right now. Acquiring competent people in the areas they need is very, very difficult. And you hear stories about people getting, like, I've heard stories about, you know, mid-level programmers getting $1 million signing bonuses, not just stock at some major Silicon Valley firms. If you're a programmer and you live anywhere else in the country, you should try to move there. If you really would like to make your fortune and then retire early, this might be the time to push that button. But so I know that it's not just an issue of Apple being able to throw on, let's say, $2 billion and, like, solve iTunes. Like, who knows what it would cost? They may literally be unable to get enough people to work on the project as quickly as they would prefer. That said, I just feel like there's a structural issue about how they are approaching our experience with their software that and their websites and so forth that is gradually improving in certain areas. Like, go to appleid.apple.com. If you were there a few months ago and you go today, it is night and day. It is so much better. It's so much clearer, so much less confusing for new users. However, related to security, Apple said they were rolling out a new two-factor authentication system last September. I still can't get it to work. They said they're rolling out slowly. Well, how slowly are they? It's not even available as an option for me now. I can't even, and I meet all the criteria. I don't know anyone using it. That's a big misstep. They rebuilt the site partly to support this new system, even though it supports regular logins and the older two-step method that's still available. But that tells me again, like, what did they do that didn't let them make this massive technological update that they promised? Why is that not happening at the pace they suggested? So, you know, but the site works much better for everyone. When you lose your ID or you need to log in and manage things, it's night and day compared to what was there for many years.
We only have a couple minutes left, so I want to ask you the jackpot question now.
Yeah.
So given all we talked about with Apple, that's development issues, iTunes, Apple TV, we're pretty sure they're working on an electric car. Do you think Apple's using its AI technology to develop personal robots?
I don't know, but a car is a robot. So that's what I would say.
It is. I've written that myself. It's a robot on wheels with airbags.
I'm really curious. I spent some time working on a story for The Economist last year about robotics. You know, some of it was about drones. Some of it was about machine learning and computer vision. It's a very interesting field. And I just scraped the surface in writing a slice through about robots and computer vision. And there is so much happening so fast because every small advance is multiplied by increases in computational power. It used to be that the algorithms were just too underpowered by the technology they had to be useful. Now they're improving both in terms of what the technology can do and then and the performance. And so things that were infeasible are now – I mean, the fact that Siri works, voice recognition is considered essentially a solved problem. Not completely, but as close to as you can get, because the accuracy with, you know, arbitrary voices and no training is now super high compared to, you know, think 10 years ago, 5 years ago, the curve went zoom up in the air because the application of a newly practical algorithm that just needed tons of computational power, both on the mobile side and on back-end server side. So that's not done. They're going to still work. They're getting to, you know, it was 50% and it was 70, now it's 95, and they're going to get it to 99.999 eventually, excuse me, or as close to that as they can. So there's all these things that can happen. The question to me is, with all the resources Apple has, what's the best application of this to them to do something? And I always like to think about Apple in terms of where they will spend the least amount of money in doing customer service and support, right? So when people said Apple's going to become a cell carrier, I said, no, they're not, because they have to deal with millions of phone calls a year from customers. And they have to deal with that 24/7 cycle. That's not like my phone broke. Okay, we'll go to a store, we'll get you a new one, or we'll FedEx you one. There's people calling them all the time. And the same thing with Apple's going to sell a, I don't know. Apple Car actually seems problematic because of the dealer system and the support for that. But I can see them potentially doing that. Robots.
Tesla's doing okay.
Yeah. And when Tesla's got, they start in the high end, they go to the low. And Apple will probably be selling, you know, if they sell a car, it's going to be a $60,000 or $70,000 car, certainly.
You think so?
To start with. I can't imagine they're going to go out of the gate with a 30 grand car or a 15 grand car. I think it's going to be a premium, like not super premium, you know, $100,000 plus. But I think it's going to be above, a middle class car, because I don't think it's feasible to start lower. I may be wrong. This may be where they're shepherding their money, and maybe they pour so much into it that they assume they're going to ramp up and they could sell something, but maybe 35 grand, not 20, not 25. That's my claim chowder. You can file that. But I think robotics it's an area that we don't quite know yet what needs to be done. So we have 2 million plus Roombas have been sold. It's a very mature niche. We've got drones. People are fascinated about those. A lot of those have some autonomy, even though they have to be controlled by operators, and we'll get a lot more over time. There's a lot more coming there. But what other categories of robots we'll need that will actually prove effective, and both at what they do and be able to be at a price point people will buy?
I think there's a lot of the psychology of how people react to the robots. How they respond physically, whether they feel threatened by the robot, whether the robot is too snoopy, whether the robot, like your smartphone perhaps, tries to know too much about you to help you out.
Oh, yeah. It's how much
social issues.
Elder care is huge, and I hear about this. I mean, Japan, it's big because of a demographic bulge. Other countries have the same problem. America, a little less so, but we're going to move into it. And when I talk to folks in robotics, a lot of them talk about factory automation is one thing, not to eliminate workers often, but to supplement and amplify them. So both in warehouses and in assembly, the robots are a way to produce have more productivity with the same number of people, as opposed to, say, in the past, eliminate 90% of your workforce. It's a force amplifier, but then in the other side of it will be – I mean, that's one big area that's still coming because the robots are getting better at working alongside people. But elder care is huge. It's just think about the number of people you need, a companion, assistance, lift somebody up, get them to a bathroom, dispense the proper medication, send video images to a doctor, take their pulse. Amazing things.
Amazing. Glenn, I wish we could go on. We could talk for another 45 minutes.
I believe it's true. I could talk for any length of time.
But unfortunately, we are out of time. So
much appreciated.
We're going to have to drop it here and maybe come back and visit later.
That'd be great.
I want to thank you so much for being on the show. Tell the listeners how they can contact you.
Well, I can be found at my blog, which is glog, glog.glenf.com, glog.glenf.com. Or you can find me on Twitter, where I often recommend to people, you may not want to follow me because of my volume, but it's at glenf, glenf. And I warn you ahead of time.
Yes. And listeners, I hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you very much for coming by. We'll see you next time on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.